Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in South Central Iowa and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA and KRLS. Now with today's In-Depth, here's Dr. Bob Leonard.
It's the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Let's go in depth with Karen Kodrowski with the Carrie Chapman Catt Center at Iowa State University. Karen, what's the 19th Amendment?
The 19th Amendment enfranchised women. So what it was added to the Constitution, and technically it prohibits states from using sex as a reason to deprive any citizen of the right to vote.
And it's 100 years old.
Yes. So it was ratified fully and added to the Constitution on August 26th of 1920. So this is its centennial anniversary year.
So that means, I mean, I'm dating myself, but that means my grandmother was in her 20s before she could vote.
Yes, absolutely. And there are many people who are alive today whose, you know, grandparents or even their mothers were alive when and born at a time when they when women did not have the right to vote across the country.
Well, for us, it's hard to understand why women wouldn't have the right to vote. It was just a completely different time.
Yes, it was. But the belief, the dominant belief at the time was that the men in the family, their fathers, their husbands, or in the case of widows with male children, their sons, that they voted as representatives of the entire family. And that when the men voted, they were actually also voting on behalf of the women, just as we think of adults as voting on behalf of any children they might have in their family today. There was also a widespread belief that, you know, voting was in the public sphere, was politics, and that was the world of men, whereas women's domain was within the home and the family. And women as the moral authorities in the family and the moral guide to the next generation would be tainted if they became active in the rowdy, crass and rough and tumble world of politics, that they might actually be corrupted and lose their moral authority.
Well, that implies that, well, I guess we can, you know, we realize this today, but I think we hope to be more optimistic than that, and that politics is amoral. Is that what they're concluding?
That was the belief at the time, that that politics was, you know, yes, it was immoral. And of course, at the time, voting was not secret as it is today. It was often very public. And in fact, there was a great deal of what we would see corruption today. People voting multiple times, that there would be purchasing of votes, that other people would be filling in empty ballots and do ballot stuffing. So, you know, politics was not a pretty scene in the 19th century when this debate was hot and heavy. And a lot of people believe that women could best influence the direction of the country through their traditional roles in the home and the family. Suffrage was also opposed by some really important corporate interests. The women's suffrage movement was closely tied to the temperance movement. So liquor industries were aligned against women's suffrage. Also, the women's suffrage movement was closely aligned with the women's labor unions, especially like in the textile industry, which was heavily female dominated. And that brought a lot of immigrant women into the and working class women into the suffrage movement. And of course, then industry opposed any opposed women's suffrage because they worried that these women voters would be voting in a number of reforms that would affect their bottom line. You know, things like a minimum wage or maximum, you know, working hours or a 40-hour work week or even break times, mandatory break times. All of those were things that were advocated for by women's labor unions before they became universally accepted.
So the women led the way on that? It wasn't the more
absolutely.
Traditional?
Yes, absolutely. And that led to actually a lot of heavy industry opposing, opposing women's suffrage as well. The Roman Catholic Church, which is very powerful, especially in the Northeast and parts of Texas and Louisiana, also opposed women's suffrage, again, on the basis that it would undermine the traditional roles within the family.
More in depth after this.
I continued my conversation about the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment with Karen Kodrowski with the Carrie Chapman Catt Center at Iowa State University. Well, yes, and I bet a lot of the white males didn't like the immigrant women having power, too. I bet they were relying
on... Yeah, and in fact, there were a lot of nativist arguments that were going on at the time, that a lot of suffragists would argue that, you know, they as quote-unquote good Americans, which was sort of a code word for meaning white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, i.e. not immigrants, not Catholic, not Southern and Eastern European, that they were real Americans and deserved the right to vote, whereas the immigrants who came in who were ignorant, they didn't understand American traditions, those men were automatically granted the right to vote, and that they believed that they were less deserving. So yes, certainly the idea that immigrant women would expand, the number of so-called ignorant voters was another basis for opposition. And in the American South, they believed that that if the 19th Amendment passed, that African-American women would be enfranchised. And in fact, that was true, that it would have and did enfranchise African-American women, even in the South. And so that was a basis for huge, strong opposition in the South, was that it would undermine white supremacy. And in fact, in a number of Southern states, it took some time for them to pass laws that extended the disenfranchisement from African-American men to African-American women. So actually in 1920, we saw some African-American women registering and voting in Southern states, but that was short-lived, sadly.
Until when?
Well, by 1924, the next presidential election, women were African-American women were effectively disenfranchised across the states in the South. And then, of course, they remained disenfranchised in the American South until the Voting Rights Act. Importantly, though, there were 500,000 African-American women in 1920 who were fully enfranchised because they lived in states such as Iowa that allowed African-Americans to vote, that there was no voting prohibitions against their African-American citizens. And then when you see going on between 1920 and 1960 with the building of, the automobile industry in Michigan and so forth, is what we call the African-American diaspora. And that means that African-American families move from the American South to the industrial Northeast and Midwest for the job opportunities that were there and for greater freedom and less discrimination. So that by the time you get to 1960, which is the last census before the 1965 Voting Rights Act, there are over 2 million African-American women who are enfranchised because they move with their families and move into states where African-American women have the right to vote.
More in depth after this.
I continued my conversation about the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment with Karen Kodrowski with the Carrie Chapman Catt Center at Iowa State University. So when was the Voting Rights Act? Early 60s, right?
1965.
And so this just reminds me of something I knew once, but somehow I've forgotten that, that's, I mean, I was 11 years old, and up until I was 11 years old, women, African-American women, couldn't vote. That's just astounding to me.
African-American women in the American South could not vote. So where there was Jim Crow legislation that prohibited, you know, we'd use literacy tests or poll taxes or other means to disenfranchise African-Americans. So, yes, this is a very recent change. And then when you think about it, too, one of the things that made the 19th Amendment so contentious is that it was only the second attempt to use the United States Constitution to define who voters are. The first one was the 15th Amendment, which enfranchised African-American men. The second time was the 19th Amendment. Now, since then, you know, we've seen the 23rd Amendment, which enfranchised the voters in the District of Columbia for presidential elections. We've seen the elimination of poll taxes in the 24th Amendment. We've seen the expansion of voting to 18 to 20 to 21-year-olds with the 26th Amendment. So now we're quite accustomed, and with the Voting Rights Act, that the federal government plays a role in defining who voters are. But in 1920 and the seven decades preceding that of the suffrage movement, that was not at all considered a legitimate power of the national government. And that's one of the reasons why the expansion of voting rights was so terribly contentious.
Now, my understanding is that there were some powerful, influential Iowa women that helped lead this movement. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Absolutely. So the women's suffrage movement, which spanned over 70 years, really covered three generations. And a prominent Iowan that represents the first generation is Amelia Bloomer, who eventually settled in Council Bluffs, Iowa. And Amelia Bloomer, for those women who are listening, if you're wearing pants, you can thank Amelia Bloomer. She was a fashion reformer, pointing out the hazards and the health care ramifications of those corsets and heavy petticoats, and she advocated a style of dress that included a fairly long, sort of a T-length skirt over a set of sort of bloused pants that was far more comfortable and far easier and safer for women to wear. But she also, crucially, introduced Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony to each other in Seneca Falls, New York. And those two became the founders of the American Equal Rights Association and later the National Woman Suffrage Association. And they were the strongest and earliest advocates for a constitutional amendment to enfranchise women. The second generation is represented by Carrie Chapman Catt, who was born in Wisconsin and grew up in Charles City, Iowa, on a small farm. And she eventually graduated from Iowa State University. And she went on to be Susan B. Anthony's handpicked successor as the leader of the largest, most prominent women's suffrage organization, the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And she is the author of The Winning Plan, which the National American Women's Suffrage Association used to, as its strategy, to lead to the final ratification of the 19th Amendment. So she literally changed history coming from Iowa, and without, I think, Iowa's influence on her development, where she saw her father go off and vote in the 1876 election, but her mother could not accompany him. You know, she says that she was 13 years old, and that's what made her a feminist and a suffragist. And so without those experiences, you know, who knows when the 19th Amendment might have been ratified.
Wow. And the third generation?
The third generation, I think, is best typified by Alice Paul and her generation. And Alice Paul is from New Jersey, but she was a good 30 years younger than Carrie Chapman Catt, and she led, at the time of the ratification, a sort of a competing suffrage organization. It was much smaller than Catt's organization, the National American Association. Catt led the National Woman's Party, but Catt brought a much more militant perspective was. She was young and impatient compared to Carrie Chapman Catt. Paul was young and impatient. And so she instituted the policy of picketing the White House during World War One to sort of embarrass President Wilson into supporting the 19th Amendment, when prior to that he had been either opposed or neutral. What she ended up doing, though, was this these daily pickets that were highly critical of President Wilson were seen as even treasonous and incendiary and unpatriotic during the fervor of World War One, is that it really pushed Woodrow Wilson to working with Carrie Chapman Catt. Catt was then seen as sort of the more reasonable, tempered, and politically astute leader of the women suffrage movement, and so he negotiated with her and worked with her to develop an endorsement of the 19th Amendment and to lobby the Senate to pass the amendment so that it could go to the states.
Well, and as we close, what's the most important lesson from this that we should take home today?
I think the most important thing to know is in our history books, we might have been told that in 1920, women were given the right to vote. Women were not given the right to vote. Women had to work very hard and fight for the right to vote. And they had to come over enormous obstacles in order to do so. And too often, American history kind of skates over the contributions of women. But yet, a number of the tactics that we see that were used in the civil rights movement, such as peaceful protest and picketing and using churches to organize and so forth, were actually done by suffragists a half a century before. So we have a lot to thank them for. And as people go and cast their votes in this election year, they should remember the struggles of all of these voting advocates that we have seen who've been working towards a more inclusive democracy.
Thanks to Karen Kodrowski for contributing to the program.
For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
An audio copy of today's in-depth program is available at KNIAKRLS.com on demand or for download. Just click podcasts. If you have topics or show ideas you'd like to hear in depth, contact KNIAKRLS by sending an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's local news and the number one news and information source in South Central Iowa is KNIAKRLS.